See, 1,825 days. That's how long it's been since Keshae Jacobs was last seen here near Chimborazo Park. And as time goes on, her mother says she is not giving up in her search for answers, and she hopes that you won't either.
She used to like to hug all the time. For no reason, Mom, I need a hug. And I'd be like, oh God, Keshae, I just gave you a hug.
It's the little things.
She had fat fingers and I used to play with her fingers.
Tony Jacobs misses the most.
And we like scary movies. We used to sit on the bed and pretend like, you know, we at the movie theater laying in the bed with the blanket.
About her daughter, Keshae Jacobs, after she disappeared without a trace.
I never thought that it would be 5 years and my daughter still wouldn't be home.
On September 26, 2016, Keshae, who was 21 at the time, visited a friend's house near Richmond's Chimborazo Park. She texted her mother saying she made it there safely and that she'd see her tomorrow. But Tony still waits for that tomorrow, 5 years later.
That was the last time I talked to my daughter or see my daughter.
There are no new updates at the moment.
Clarence Key III with the Richmond Police Department is the lead detective on Keshae's case. Investigators previously determined that foul play is suspected.
We feel that, and we felt all along, that there are individuals out there that know a lot more than what they're saying.
They hope renewed attention surrounding Keshae on the fifth anniversary of her disappearance will spark new leads.
If something happened to your family member, you want somebody to help you. So I'm asking, I'm begging, and I'm pleading to please help me, help my daughter.
And help bring closure to a heartbroken mother.
Baby, I love you, and I miss you so much. And mommy's not stopping till I find you. I'm gonna find you. And I'm gonna bring you home. And I love you, and I love you, I love you, I love you.
As the 24-hour mark hits, Tony takes matters into her own hands.
So I woke up like maybe 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and I put my clothes on, and I went knocking on people's doors that I knew about. And I called my sister, and I was like, I can't find Kiki. And I was hysterical. And she's like, go to the police precinct and report her missing. And when I got in there, I was crying, and I told the police officer, I was like, I can't find my daughter. He was like, how old is your daughter? I said, she just turned 21. He was like, looked at me, like, how you know she just don't want to be bothered? I was like, because I'm her mother and I know her routine. So I literally had to pull my phone out and show this police officer that, look, this is my daughter. She calls me all day, every day.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I was the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. I've got a real interest in real crime, these minds that solve these crimes, and these advocates that get out there to try their best to solve crimes and bring attention to these crimes to the media, which leads us into our next series of cases.
We're going to be analyzing and discussing the cases highlighted in the HBO series Black and Missing, as well as the underlying issues that are driving these cases. We've already started our discussion with Soledad O'Brien, the executive producer of the series, but we'll take our analysis even deeper in these next few episodes. It's just an atrocious reality in this country, and I don't know about other countries, but it certainly is here, that there are more Black missing people than are proportionally expected. In other words, they make up 13% of the population, but 40% of the missing people. What the fuck?
Yeah, it's so alarming. And firstly, wahey for advocates. You know, mostly they start unpaid and doing the work really of law enforcement. And I've got huge admiration for all advocates, but for the advocates that we see in Black and Missing. And it's a four-part docu-series. So if you haven't watched it, we, Jim, Lisa, and Laura, highly recommend that you do. It's on HBO. Soledad O'Brien and multiple Emmy Award winner Geeta Gansbier, have I pronounced her surname right? Mm-hmm. they've basically put this together, and it's really quite remarkable. And yes, Jim, I had a gut reaction to it. Not just the trailer, I did dive in straight away. And my goodness, the statistics. And of course, whatever stats are quoted, we know it's tip of the iceberg. But right. I think the fact that they put right out there at the start that Black people remain missing or the case unresolved four times longer than those of white people, that wasn't a stat that I was familiar with. But it's really the motivation behind the foundation. So you see the work of the advocates, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But yes, I mean, this really is a masterpiece. You know, my gut reaction to it was that it could have been so dark and depressing and hopeless and helpless if it weren't for the incredible women on the show and just the acts of humanity that we're seeing right before our eyes unfolding. So I don't know how you felt about it, Lisa, and we are going to talk about each of the cases because we all felt so strongly about the cases that we were seeing. Right. Some of them get resolved in the docu because it's over a three-year period, and that's what makes this docu-series stand out as well. You're seeing things unfold in real time, and it's really gritty. Even the music is jarring. I kind of had a visceral reaction even to the music. It made me feel uncomfortable, and quite right. We should all be bloody uncomfortable watching this, and we should all feel enraged. That's how I feel about it. Maybe I'm just an angry woman at the moment, probably a bit of that.
Please, please rage on, sister. I completely agree with how you're characterizing it. And for me, what was really remarkable is how unsensational this documentary was, how quietly provocative. It's not flashy. It doesn't have reenactments. It doesn't have dun 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 and smoking guns and big cliffhangers. It was so not a Hollywood, if I can say that. It was not a typical Hollywood docuseries that we've been accustomed to. It wasn't lurid or indulgent. It was just this,
because it's produced and directed by women.
Yes. Well, and
but you're
and
right, not, Lisa.
And the great thing about Soledad's involvement in this is, like, she could have put her face on the front of this and been all over the docu-splaining it to us. And I just love that she stepped back and let the voices of Derica and Natalie, this sister-in-law dynamic duo
who
make up, who are the founders of Black and Missing Foundation. And she lets them and their helpers, they're angels. They are angels on earth, the people who do this work. And their quiet determination, they're fierce and they're dedicated, but they just keep going day after day.
And this is not their full-time job.
No,
I mean, they have full-time jobs, and they do this in at night and on weekends in all of their spare time. And they've really made a change in so many lives. And they have some volunteers like Derek Butler. And I think we've talked about this before, Laura, about how people who have suffered severe trauma carry it with them. And you can see on the weight on his shoulders and the expression on his face, even when he's smiling, there is sadness.
Oh, yeah.
Sadness. And it's just, it touched me. And you look at the circumstances where his sister, who he loved and talked to all the time, and obviously their mother, who just was carrying the burden of her missing daughter for all those years. And it's just terrible. This is terrible.
Meeting Thelma, the mum, because we get the opportunity to see the family and how it impacts all of them, don't we? And I think that that's really important too. So I agree with you, Jim, but he's a quiet storm, isn't he? He really is just
this. I wrote that too. Oh,
quiet energy that you would imagine is, well, you don't need to imagine, you see it. He just has this tenacity about him, this dogged determination. And I think that's what we see across this series, the determination and the courage, the humanity. I mean, it really touched me as well, Jim. I think from each of the real cases that we're introduced to, each of the, it's primarily mums, isn't it? Apart from Derek, but primarily mums having to advocate for their daughters that have gone missing that no one cares about. But yes, let's get into the cases. Lisa, were you going to ask a question before?
No,
we
I was just going to ask you if you wanted to just kind of define what the Black and Missing Foundation actually is, what they do as a nonprofit organization, the many things that they do.
So the Black and Missing Foundation is really, it began with two women and the Wilsons. What incredible women they are. Derica, who's former law enforcement. And I think that's a very important part of the story, that she's been there. She's been within the organizations, knowing how they operate. First Black officer, Black female police officer in Falls Church, Virginia. And she got involved in some missing persons cases, but it's Derica and Natalie Wilson, who works in public relations, and she's an expert in public relations. And they realize through their own experiences that media are just so important in helping resolve cases. And I think the point that's made in episode one really just stood out to me, that they say that the FBI reports 600,000 people go missing. Well, in particular, in 2019, 600,000 people went missing, 240,000 people of color. Name three of them. Yeah. And that question, can you name three, came up post Gabby Petito, didn't it? And I think it's resonated so many times for me, certainly in my career. When I was at New Scotland Yard, we had exactly the same, actually, that people saying all the resources go into white cases, not into people of color. And so that fact alone, where they, I think it's Natalie who says, I guarantee you'll come up short. You won't be able to name three. That's really the onus behind why they set up the foundation, knowing that media can make a big difference, social media and so on. And it really is about that their, I guess their strap line is helping us bring us home, which is at the front line, grassroots, two women in an organization. It's called an organization, but it's not really, is it? It's bootstrapped. I don't know where they get their funding from, and we know we want to help them in some way. So Jim will say something about that, but they have volunteers. But that's the core ethos of what they do. And it's incredible that they juggle so much as mothers as well, because I think they make that point, they're mothers first. And therefore, if your mother's first, that humanity and the truth seeking comes through the whole way through when they're advocating, that they're putting in phone calls, they're doing the basic things, the legwork, and chasing law enforcement, because they know that the media spotlight, when you put it on law enforcement, it means they have to do something. Right. And you know that happens, Jim. So
absolutely. So, yeah, so they're smart about this. And I think it's because one of them was in law enforcement and one of them was in media. And so they realize that media coverage puts pressure on law enforcement, that direct access to law enforcement doesn't necessarily get the results they need. I mean, these mothers call law enforcement. These families are reaching out, trying to get them to do something. And they're told, oh, she must have run away. Oh, she'll come back. Oh, don't worry about it. That kind of stuff. When if that was a middle class or upper class white girl, they would have pulled all the alarms. Everything would have been out there. All the different media would have been there. And so the media coverage was the way in. If they could force their way into the media coverage, then that would put pressure on law enforcement to get more involved. And we saw it play out in front of our eyes over these four episodes. So the first case they cover is Keisha Jacobs. She's a 21-year-old, and she had apparently had her friends drop her off at this house, and then she goes missing. The cops wait 2 days to respond to her mother. 2 days. So the mother goes to this house. She talks to the friend. She does the interviews that the cops should have done. She talks to the friend. She finds out where they dropped her off, and she knocks on the door, and a man answers. And he says something like, oh, yeah, I saw her last Wednesday, just trying to pretend that, oh, it was a long time ago. But the fact is, the mother knew that she had been home last Wednesday at 5 o'clock when the guy said he saw her. And then he goes, oh, well, maybe it was 6 o'clock. And she reports this to the police. Again, 2 days they wait. And then when they go, they don't find her there. So they literally wash their hands of it. They don't do anything. They just say, oh, she probably doesn't want to be here. And this is the foundation of the problem. Mm. It has to be treated. We all know when somebody goes missing, the most critical time is that first 24 hours. For children who were abducted and killed, that first 24 hours, 99% of them are already dead in the first 24 hours. The first hour, 43% are killed. The first 3 hours, 73% are killed. In the first 24 hours, 99% of the kids who were abducted and killed are killed within that time frame. You can't wait one day. You can't wait 2 days. You certainly can't wait a week or a month or a year. And that's what's happened in some of these cases.
Yeah. And I think the important thing to add is that mom reports to police, but she tells them that she talks to her daughter every day. And we know very well, Jim, baseline behavior is really important in missing person cases. So if you've got someone who never goes missing, who talks to mom, who's, you know, well networked in with family and has those conversations, then you've got something irregular happening. And mom saying, I'm really worried. And yet to wait 2 days is just, well, you can say we have so many cases, but the point is you have to work out which are the cases that you have to focus on. And it just sounds to me that there's just so much blindness to what the red flags are, which when we talk about present day, and I wrote this in an article I wrote for The Telegraph yesterday, you can talk to anybody who watches true crime or listens to true crime podcasts. They will tell you how important the first 24 hours are. They will tell you about past behavior being the best predictor of future behavior. There's so much knowledge now about real crime, true crime, red flag behavior. And yet, Jim, the frustration for me is it seems to be law enforcement seem to be blind to that knowledge. Not all law enforcement, but I think we have to acknowledge the failures that when you're just marking people up as runaways, you're basically just saying, well, it's their choice to go from A to B. And therefore, whatever happens to them on the street isn't a matter for us.
It's just like in the JG case that we talked about. I mean, time after time after time, a boy, a teenage boy or a young man would, quote, go missing and the cops just wrote him off, you know. 3, 5, 7, 9, 12, 15, 18, 20, up to 32.
When do the red flag and warning bells start ringing?
Really? And how many of those cases was JG implicated in? They had a good suspect. In these cases, you see the same thing. These cases that are highlighted in Black and Missing, you see girl after girl go missing and the family is turned away. They're not even getting a response from the police department, much less any kind of initiative being taken on the part of the cops to do an investigation in those critical first 24 hours.
And they also raised the stat that Black girls and women in particular go missing at disproportionately higher rates than other groups. And if it's disproportionate, I know this from working the cases in London. You know, London's one of the most diverse capital cities in the world. And I would hear from Black women in the Black communities, and they would say that we don't report domestic abuse. We don't talk to police because we don't trust them and no one's interested in hearing our voices. And we don't feel we have the confidence to speak out even about our own relations and our own households, what's going on. And therefore, when you have got people reaching out, it makes it even more significant. That for me, again, is a red flag when you have a mum, because they don't want to talk to law enforcement. They're talking because they have to. And that's an awful thing to say. But I spent a lot of the time when we set up the Racial and Violent Crime Task Force talking to people about why they don't talk to us and trying to find out what we have to do to be better at listening and reaching people. And oftentimes, Jim and Lisa, and we've talked about this before in the Building Bridges episodes, haven't we? So again, to our listeners, yes, please listen to our previous episodes with Mariana and Richard from the Building Bridges Project. Really important that we talk about communication and building trust and confidence and rapport. And it takes time to build trust and confidence. So again, with this particular docuseries, I think we have to watch things like this. We have to make programs like this. They have to be exposés showing what's really going on. And people say, oh, there's so much criticism of law enforcement. But from my experience, it's the only way that they get better. I used to say that in the Met at New Scotland Yard. It's the only way we can improve is have advocates help us and shine a light on how we need to improve, because you can have the best police leaders, you can have incredible leaders, but culture is what the problem, or where the problem lies.
And it training. Lies in
culture and training, not just having one great figurehead or two great leaders or even five great leaders. It's got to be from the bottom up and top down. It's about cultural change.
That's something that we do see later. We'll get to this later in the documentary, in this episode. But there is somebody who does do some training. Can't remember his name, but he was a law enforcement. And he admitted that he had had biases and he had had blinders on. And now he's out there training people on how to get a runaway to trust you, how to see more than just what's on the surface. And he's not only training law enforcement, he's training EMTs. He's training anybody who is out there, you know, with people who are vulnerable and at risk.
Right. Yeah, but I wish he would use the right terminology, because in 2021, I don't know about you, Jim, I can see you smiling, but I was just cringing. You know, great he's doing human trafficking training, great he's challenging stereotypes and mindsets, but there's no such thing as a child prostitute. I want to make that very clear. And there's no such thing as Stockholm syndrome. We keep bumping up against these things, and I really feel we need to get more information out there. And I know lots of police officers actually contacted me just this weekend about the piece I had in the Telegraph about serial perpetrators. And there are many who want to change, who spend time listening to our podcasts and crime analysts, and they reach out and they say, I've had this moment and I vow to do better. And they're open and transparent, and they are the people who are going to make these changes. But we really have to hold people to account, because I don't want people being trained using all the terminology that's out of date. And that creates even more problems going forward when we keep hearing child prostitute and underage woman, you know, when we're talking about children.
And stranger danger.
Yeah, stranger danger. Just all these misnomers that actually just create more problems. And also with domestic abuse, he talked about trauma bonds, which more often we're seeing coercive control, not trauma bonds. So again, I felt that there, yes, he put some good information out there about the perpetrators being master manipulators, and that it can be difficult to get rapport with the victims who don't see themselves as victims. But it just in that little clip, there were so many problems with his terminology that I wonder how much more, if I'd sat there in one of the classes, would I have been raising my hand every 2 minutes?
So I'm glad you're saying that. I'm glad you. I totally missed that. You know, I told when he said trauma bond, I was like, oh, good. I'm glad that he's explaining that. But, you know, I had totally missed the part where he said all those other things.
Yeah, and I want to see diverse trainers. You know, I want to see young Black advocates in there in police training talking. You know, that shouldn't be sort of a wow moment. You should be having community partners come in and talk. I would have loved to have seen Derica in there and Natalie talking. But yes, that's how we get better. And I know that because I used to bring people like them in and stand with me and deliver the training. And now I'm one of those advocates that goes in as well. So yes, training is absolutely key to change the culture. But let's get the right information going out there. So yes, we hear about Keisha Jacobs and her going missing and police not contacting her mum for 2 days. And then the episode actually turns their attention. What we see on screen is Derica and her talking from her previous law enforcement training and her perspective. And she talks about a case where she was looking for a missing person. And while she was out on the street, a woman literally ran at her and had bite marks all over her and was in a really terrible state. So she then did some checks on this particular lady and found out that she was missing herself and that she had been held within a motel room. And she was missing from a neighboring town. But she says, but the flyer didn't come across my desk. I mean, this again, you know, they make the point very well that firstly, missing people are not a priority and weren't a priority in the police. And I think we've seen that across all police forces. That's not just something over here. Missing people not being a priority. How do you know that something sinister has happened? Well, that's where you need experts helping them work out which are the cases that you need to prioritize. But the fact that they were reliant on flyers, I mean, I joined the job when it was all in hard copy. They were called spec rims that you used to get, or used to get bulletins from Borough. you know, obviously now we have computerized systems, but the fact is people think that law enforcement have these whiz-bang systems that joins everything up. But in reality, that's not what happens. And just by very virtue of the fact you've got one area where someone goes missing, of course they can be moved or they can travel to another area. So of course you need to have it joined up. And of course you need law enforcement agencies, you know, to talk to each other, but that doesn't always happen. So that again plays into, I guess, the barriers here of problems, and particularly when you have manipulative perpetrators who exploit those things. And when we're talking about trafficking, that's exactly what they do. They exploit all the weaknesses and vulnerability, which makes it even more challenging, which is exactly why law enforcement have to get their house in order.
Yeah, that there needs to be more reach, exactly like you say. And that's, I think that's part of the premise of Black and Missing, is that if there's more media attention, then there's more reach, and then more jurisdictions know about the missing person, not just who's in your community.
Yeah, and talking to your communities. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what Derek Butler and others, you know, the volunteers, they're bridging the gap. You've kind of got this building bridges again, haven't you? You've got the advocacy, but then you've, yes, quite rightly, so the media and the push on media, but then you have community, who the Uber driver, the, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, that's what we always used to say. It's very outdated terms now, but you want everybody to be the eyes and ears. That's the whole point of putting it out to the media. So you want to build trust with the Black community. And I think that's another very important point about the Black and Missing Foundation, of what they're doing.
Right. And I think, you know, as you're talking, between the two of you, things that you've said earlier really focuses me on terminology. I mean, terminology is so important, as we see, and labeling things properly. And I think one of the problems is calling a person a missing person brings up the big question mark: are they voluntarily missing, as opposed to someone who is potentially abducted? And so I think we may have to spearhead a campaign to get rid of the word missing and literally make it endangered and unknown whereabouts, whatever it is, so people don't feel so lackadaisical. Whenever they label somebody missing, they feel like, well, they might come back on their own. You know, well, they might just be runaways. But still, if that's the case, they could still be endangered. And even if they went on their own, if they're young, obviously, they certainly are endangered. And if they aren't that young, if they're, you know, young adults or even older adults and they're missing, this is not just missing. The circumstances tell us that there was foul play. And so missing does not categorize some of these people and most of these people. And I think we really need to come up with some good terminology that is succinct and it's more accurate, that will get law enforcement off their butts and actually doing their jobs.
I think that's a very good point, Jim. You know, I always say language matters. It really matters. And you said, Lisa, it's the gateway. You know, are they missing? Have they run away? Or have they been kidnapped and something sinister has happened? And how people attribute, if it's a white person, something sinister may have happened. I mean, that doesn't always happen. It doesn't always follow through. And as we know with Gabby Petito, there are certain cases that capture the imagination of the public and the media that get resourced, but not always. But I think when we understand the statistic that one in six runaways, when people do actually run away, they're most like one in six of them are most likely to be trafficked. It's vulnerability that we're talking about as well, isn't it? The when you layer in vulnerability, and that's really what you have to be looking at, understanding risk and understanding vulnerability. But trafficking is really the hidden issue a lot of the time, that people think that trafficking happens, you know, well, I think there's a very false perception of what trafficking is and understanding what it is, and the Black children in particular are far more vulnerable. Black and brown children in particular are far more vulnerable. And I think this docuseries makes that point very well, because people are likely to put them in the bracket of, oh, they've run away, and not really care and not really pursue and put resources into trying to find them.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they did with Amaria Hall, who went missing July 7th, 2019. And one of the great things that this documentary does is it really paints the picture of Amaria. It talks about how she was an honor roll student, even though she'd been so ill in seventh and eighth grade, you know, and how it seems like she was groomed online. And she was suffering such loneliness and felt like this was the only person who understood her. And as Jim and Laura know, last year I had a brush with this with my own son who was starting to be groomed online. And I'm a very vigilant parent, I thought, you know, he knows all about
all the risks and dangers,
all the red flags. And yet he was groomed. And it just this particular case of Amaria, I just could see it, you know, her loneliness, her wanting to be understood by this other person online.
And it happens a lot, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, that's the problem, that when you get to particularly teenage years, you know, the angst and the isolation and the no one understands me. And
the trying to stand on your own two feet and become an adult by pushing away your parents and guardians. And that makes you even more ultimately vulnerable, because literally you're looking for people outside to look up to and idolize and spend time with. And of course, those people outside, the good ones, great. But there are bad ones who seek out children in that space in their life and take advantage of them. And we all know that the most prolific child sex offenders are those male offenders who target adolescent male victims. They are the most prolific offenders. And that is because they set themselves up in situations, coaches and teachers and community leaders and nice guys and groomers that groom not only the children, their parents and guardians, but also the community. We really need to find an umbrella term that covers missing, abducted, and murdered, because all of those things are possible when somebody goes missing, right? They could be runaways, but still endangered. They could be abducted. They could be murdered. And anytime somebody goes missing, that should have the highest priority, because it actually covers all of those possibilities, all of which means that they are at risk and vulnerable and in danger, and they need to be found. And the faster you're out there looking, the more likely you'll be able to find them alive.
So even though Amaria went missing in the morning, her mom came in and she was gone and she had left a note, and the law enforcement was like, well, she's just a runaway. And they just had no sense of urgency.
She was 16 years old.
No Amber Alert. Yeah.
Well, just turned 16, hadn't she? And I think the note is important. I'm going away. I'm not coming back. Don't look for me or you'll make it worse.
Yeah. Well, you'll make it worse. Obviously, she's saying it is bad. There is something wrong, and it will be worse if you come look for me. Well, that's all the reason you need to look for her.
But does that sound to you like something somebody told her to write? Like, don't look for me, you'll make it worse. Like it's some kind of threat in a way.
Well, it talks to some kind of coercion, doesn't it? That there's some other force at play, i.e. it's not necessarily her own free will.
Right. If she was just going away and trying to find a job somewhere and live another life, how does looking for her make it worse? It's only worse if there's a commanding force, a controlling force out there that is going to treat her even worse if the parents come looking for her. And so that letter, that note, should have been the biggest red flag to law enforcement. Instead, they use this as an excuse not to get involved. Wash their hands of it. Look, you know, she's obviously running away on her own. Don't worry about it. That's just bullshit. That should have really gotten them, oh, wow, something is really wrong here. And you're right, Lisa. There's many online groomers who will coach children. And believe me, she's still a child. She's 16 years old. Coach children how to destroy the evidence of their online interactions before they leave, how to get away from the house with whatever they need in a way that their parents won't know. Leave notes like this or messages so that they don't keep looking for them. all those things are part of the grooming package. And we see it all the time in online grooming cases.
So yes, with Amaria, unfortunately, it's left up to her mum. And again, we just see these incredible women having to do, you know, go above and beyond. And she gets a tip that Amaria has been seen at a house. And so she goes off to see if she can find her. Now, again, it's mums putting themselves potentially in harm or right. harm's way. She doesn't know what she's going to find, but she does see her daughter and she looks away immediately because her daughter gets out of a car, but also a man who's 6'4", who's got a gun. And I'm just looking at my note. I wrote, bloody hell, mm-hmm. you know, imagine. And I always try and put myself in someone's shoes. And now being a mom, you know, imagine tracking down your child and then seeing a 6'4" guy get out the car and he's got a gun and feeling so powerless. What do you actually do in those situations? It's
I mean,
frightening for people and you feel so powerless.
Right. And you and I would think, all right, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to call 911. I'm going to keep my eyes on her. But obviously her interactions in the past with the cops about this case were so negative and off-putting and insufficient that she didn't have confidence that they would come running and save her daughter. And what did they do? They waited and she wasn't there. And so they again wash their hands of it.
And mum's still calling up Jim and they don't follow up and they don't call her back. You know, I literally was tearing out my hair hearing that. Because again, I always say to people, it takes one phone call. You know, it's so, you know, it's just not courteous. The very bottom line is, it's just not courteous when you've got a mum who's at the end of her tether, who's terrified for her daughter, and she's calling to find out what's being done and she's not even getting a call back. And again, this is the power of the foundation, isn't it? That we then see Natalie pick up the phone, speak to the police officer on behalf of mum to find out what's happening. And it's really that double bind that you need law enforcement. You know, a lot of the time they do a good job, but there does need to be accountability and they do need to be called out when they don't. But to resolve these cases, you really do need law enforcement's help. But it's just so infuriating. That's how I felt. It's just, you know, and Umberto said the same. We were just so angry watching it when it's just the basic things that would just go so far in building trust and confidence of returning phone calls and saying, what's the latest? What is the update? And if you don't find, you know, the daughters, there's one thing about them being murdered, but there's also about them being trafficked and being moved. You know, moved to another state, moved to another country and disappeared forever. There's a critical window as well. Now we understand what's going on with human trafficking. And by that, I'm talking about sex trafficking, using right. young girls and exploiting them. And they might think that it's a consensual act. And that again, is the confusion, isn't it? We had a big expose on care homes, you know, foster homes, mm-hmm. where predatory men were preying on young girls, giving them mobile phones, giving them sweets, giving them alcohol, and girls thinking that, you know, these men are their saviors, but then they're passing them around their networks, using them for sex, exploiting them. And it's being reported to police and nothing gets done. That's been going on for decades. So again, these perpetrators, they understand vulnerability. They understand who the police care about and who they don't care about. It is predatory in one sense. It's hugely exploitative and they are manipulators.
Right. By the time the police actually get there, they're gone. And there apparently had been other groups of girls there. So, you know, they could potentially have not only saved Amaria, but also some other unreported missing girls or, you know, it's just so frustrating, yeah. So frustrating to watch.
So again, the foundation's work is just so important. It's advocating, it's speaking to the police officers, it's putting cases in the media, using social media as well. And they make so many important points. You know, one of the last points I just want to wrap this episode on is that African-Americans are far more vulnerable in terms of for trafficking, for all sorts of crime. And I think it's Natalie who says, but no one cares when they go missing. And that's why it's so important everyone watch this docu-series. And we're trying to characterize and talk about each of the cases for those who haven't watched it or can't access it. But I highly recommend that you do. So we still have much more to discuss, as always. We don't know what each other's going to say, and we just touch into one area or one case, and there's so much that comes out of it. So we find out at the end of episode one, so spoiler alert here, but this is a real case, and we want to make sure that we cover what we know, the beginning, middle, and end of what is shown in the docuseries, that Amaria Hall was found 2 years later and that she's safe. But what I will say is that we don't know the long-term impact of what happened to her. Yeah, and we don't know what level of trauma. It's certainly life-changing. We know that. I certainly know that from cases that I've worked, and it's talked about more in this particular docu-series. So again, you know, when they started this docu-series, they didn't know what was going to happen in each case. So it really is a very important docu-series, and I recommend everyone go watch it. So with that, we're going to wrap this episode, and we hope you lovely listeners will join us back in our next episode to discuss Black and Missing. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, or counseling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.